Today, opening the housing affordability can of worms. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news. Well, the Senate Economics Reference Committee is running an inquiry into the financial regulatory framework and home ownership. And there were some hearings late last week, which were chaired by the New South Wales Senator Andrew Bragg, with Jess Walsh, the ALP Senator for Victoria, and Green Senator Barbara Pocock, Senator for South Australia, asking the questions. And to my mind, this was a very interesting set of hearings because it did expose a number of quite significant and important issues, but it also shows that this whole question of housing affordability is not simple or straightforward. The first issue being discussed was whether, in fact, the APRA 3% buffer on lending should be changed, given, of course, that interest rates are currently quite high and probably won't go much higher. Now, Chris Taylor from the Australian Banking Association had the tiger by the tail because some of his members are advocating for significant reductions. For example, the ANZ CEO has been very outspoken on this, whereas some other banks like CBA and Westpac are saying there should be no change.
I take from your evidence so far that prudential settings should be set with prudential goals in mind. And secondly, I think that's just been established that those settings, in your view, shouldn't be set by Parliament. I wanted to ask you about your broader constituency as an industry body. And I understand you've put your ABA view forward in favour of a reduction in the serviceability buffer, but not all of your affiliates or members support that, do they? I understand, correct me if I have this wrong, but today the Financial Review reports that the Commonwealth and Westpac, who are the two largest lenders by size, believe the 3% serviceability buffer is appropriate. And the NAB is in your corner, but others are not. How do you reconcile differences within your constituency on this issue?
So as I mentioned earlier, I think banks are united in the view that this is a supply-side problem and that the solution for increasing affordability for first home buyers will be addressed by supply-side measures. And you know, each bank has also made, or many banks have made their own submissions as well on the ways in which they think that can best be achieved. Each bank also has its own approach to assessing loans, their own approach to allocating risk and their own pool of existing mortgages, and so they might have slight differences in the way that they approach these matters, but they each recognise that helping first home buyers into the market is an important area and welcome ongoing review and discussion about the most appropriate ways to do that from a policy perspective.
Let me just press you a little there, because you've come here today representing a reduction in the serviceability. I've absolutely heard you on supply, and I'm sure no one on this inquiry would be arguing about that. Supply is obviously critical. But when it comes to other issues, you represent a view which is at odds with some very significant lenders. And so I want to press you. They're in your organisation. I don't hear you representing their viewpoint.
So just to be clear, we're not suggesting a reduction in the buffer. What we're suggesting is it's worth having a conversation about whether greater flexibility is needed to ensure people can safely access credit based on the approach that each bank takes to making credit decisions. They may have slightly different perspectives about whether the existing exceptions that can be undertaken and reported to ASIC are sufficient, or whether There might need to be more enduring approaches taken specifically for flexibility for first home buyers. And that's all we're suggesting. We welcome the dialogue. You have several of the banks also appearing here today who may put forward more nuanced views on that perspective. But I think that that's really a conversation we welcome having.
So he argued that there was at least an opportunity to consider it, but was relatively non-committal overall. Martin Green and Paul Deal from Westpac argued that first home loan borrowers were significantly higher risk and that the regulations should not be changed. The 3% buffer was there for a very good reason.
From a Westpac perspective, we don't think the right answer is to put customers into more debt. We believe Australia's responsible lending and interest rate buffer settings have proven to serve our customers and the country well, particularly as we deal with this inflationary peak over the past 2 years. We do not believe that banks or the community should have an increasing willingness to accept higher levels of home loan defaults. The 90-day delinquency rate is already higher for first home buyers at 1.23% compared with the average homeowner of 1.1%. At the end of these percentages are young Australians who are going to experience hardship. In a challenging cost of living environment, we do not think it's the right to push up our customers' borrowing capacity to an absolute threshold. Owning a home is one thing, but we want to ensure our customers have sufficient discretionary income to live their lives beyond repaying their mortgage.
Mortgage average borrowing average level of repayment means that 40% of the income of the average new mortgage borrower is to service their debt at present. Is that correct, that 40%? Have I named it properly?
That assumes that the borrower is borrowing to their maximum capacity.
To the maximum. And isn't the definition in Australia of mortgage stress that's widely accepted a 30% portion of income going to mortgage out of pre-tax income?
There are various definitions, but yeah, it's widely accepted that 30%.
So more than half of Australians are in very serious trouble as they go into. They're under serious stress, I should say. And you pointed to the rates, the 90-day rate of default, which is considerably higher than it is for the average borrower for first home buyers. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I do think an important point just on the borrowing capacity conversation is that for the large part, our customer base don't borrow to the max. The vast majority don't need to borrow to the max. And I think that's also indicative of the current policy parameters not necessarily constraining lending either. If we saw a large proportion kind of hitting up against the max or borrowing to the max, I think that would be more indicative that the current policy parameters are constraining lending. But at the minute, three quarters of our population borrow well within their means, which is an important stat.
First home buyers, what proportion of them are borrowing to the max?
Relatively consistent with the broader book.
75%.
Yeah.
So that is one of the factors, apart from compassion for the pressure it would put under people. That is one of the motivations then for you not supporting a change in the prudential settings?
I think it's a statistic that helps give us a view that that's not necessarily the issue.
Andy Kerr and Ben Nichols from National Australia Bank were a little bit more open to changes, but argue that it wouldn't make a huge amount of difference because it would only be at the margin.
In our submission, we do see an opportunity to work with regulators and government in a targeted way to look at modest changes to the buffer for first home buyers, which would provide modest increases in borrowing power for first home buyers versus the broader population.
Yeah, fair enough. So you think that there could be a lower buffer for first home buyers and that might help generate more first home owners?
We think that would have a modest increase on first home buyer borrowing capacity. We do think that any implementation of a change would require other consideration of other credit risk elements to ensure that it is done safely. Examples that we've included in the inquiry are debt to income, ensuring that we do not sort of stress people on a debt to income basis. But we do think there's an opportunity to explore that, noting it is a relatively modest increase in borrowing power versus some other mechanisms which we've also suggested.
So basically, if there were more, if there was a reduction in the serviceability buffer for first home buyers, you think that some first home buyers might be able to borrow more money. But do you also think there's an opportunity for there to be some new first home buyers as a result of that change?
Well, we would see the opportunity clearly to differentially increase borrowing power would allow first home buyers to be able to compete for houses where they want to live. The recommendations on the buffer, we would say, are modest. We would need to work through the impact on that in terms of the number of new first home buyers that would avail. We note there are other issues. There has been lots of discussion already around supply. The other issue which the Home Guarantee Scheme plays well to today is the need for a deposit. And we also would recommend value in visiting the income caps there. So I think that we wouldn't see changes in a buffer as a silver bullet, but there are there is a modest opportunity there.
Is it your sense now that there are prospective first home owners that are missing out on that first loan because of the buffer?
I think, again, there are. This is a pretty complex scenario, the extent to which it's supply-side issues versus demand-side issues. It's hard to kind of isolate, I think, to a singular problem, and hence why we've put a number of recommendations to explore.
Yeah, but you have recommended a tailoring of the buffer for first home buyers. I assume you recommending that because your sense is that there would be people who are missing out on loans.
Yeah, we think that that gives first home buyer more buying power than another owner occupier investor in the market.
Yeah, okay. So there are people who could be first home buyers that aren't being first home buyers because of the buffer.
That it would be one lever and one measure that could be getting in the way today.
And they also noted that most of their customers, first-time buyers included, didn't stretch themselves to the max. And, of course, we are seeing lending growing quite fast, even with the current settings. And Commonwealth Bank's Angus Sullivan and Kylie Rickerson also argued for no change.
In the evidence presented to the committee, there are common views around several key priorities. It's been well covered. Housing stock is constrained and more homes need to be built. Homes need to be built in desirable and suitable locations, protected from extreme weather risk, with good access to public infrastructure, social amenity, and at a variety of price points. As we've said before, if we had 100 units of effort to solve this problem, we would put 98 of them against stimulating housing supply. With that said, there are questions about how we can do more to support more Australians to buy a home. Our research indicates that young Australians remain incredibly enthusiastic about buying a home, but many are understandably frustrated by their inability to enter the market. Our view is that the regulatory constraints which apply today are on the whole appropriate and reasonable. These constraints speak to achieving several important and at times competing objectives. First, it is essential that the integrity and safety of the system as a whole is protected. We have benefited in Australia from prudent policy settings and a strong and stable banking system. This means that we can access offshore funding at times through the cycle, and we're able to support customers just as we did during the COVID pandemic. Secondly, it is clear that the interests of individual borrowers need to be protected, as per your previous presentation. It is a poor outcome for consumers, banks and the community more broadly if loans are extended to too many individuals who cannot afford them reasonably. Third, healthy competition between lenders is essential and delivers both innovation and fair prices for consumers. As has been widely reported over the past 12 to 18 months, mortgage market competition is intense. Within these regulatory constraints, a range of support is available to assist specifically first home buyers into the market. We can, for example, lend at relatively higher loan-to-value ratios, which reduces the size of deposit required for a first home buyer when we rely on lenders' mortgage insurance for customers who do not yet meet their deposit requirements. CBA also supports first home buyers through partnering in the delivery of government schemes, including the federal government's home guarantee schemes, which remove the need for lenders' mortgage insurance. A number of further suggestions have been proposed throughout this inquiry, and I would like to briefly provide our views. Firstly, on serviceability buffers, the buffer is not just for interest rates, but is forward-looking across several dimensions, including unforeseen changes in a borrower's income and expenses. Forecasting future interest rates movements is challenging. While there is a widespread view that we're at the top of the interest rate cycle, the future remains uncertain. The buffer is ultimately a matter for APRA to consider, and we have every confidence that they will review the options carefully. Secondly, on HECS, we have genuine empathy for first-home buyers who have invested in their education, have taken on HECS debt, and that in turn reduces their borrowing capacity. We are bound by our obligations to protect consumers and lend responsibly and ensure that we do not lend them more than they can repay. This means we need to factor in all incoming and outgoing payments, including HECS debt. At the margins, we do have room to do more for first-home buyer customers with HECS debt who are close to a serviceability pass, and we will consider these matters and do today on a case-by-case and exception basis. Finally, in relation to the capital framework as it applies to banks both large and small, we're open for a conversation about how these arrangements could be improved, and again would suggest that APRA is best placed to make these judgments. We urge a discussion that focuses on ensuring that the underlying capital requirements remain connected to the risk of the loan, and that is especially the case with first home buyers. These are important questions which are not just economic in nature, but go to the social fabric of Australia. Fresh ideas are worthy of debate, and we look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Sullivan, for your contribution this morning. I'm just going to ask you a few questions, then hand to my Senate colleague. So I think there's been some reporting of your recent lending practices that, in fact, you've written twice as many loans for people earning more than $500,000 a year than you have for people earning under $75,000 a year. Is that right?
Yes, those numbers, I think, are in our latest reporting materials, and they are accurate.
Well, it sounds like we're becoming a nation where you've got to be a rich person to get a loan.
Look, I think, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, at the core of the challenge we see here is that a home is expensive for many individuals on lower incomes trying to enter the market. And as a result of fewer lower income individuals being able to secure an affordable home, we see a skew in the profile of income distribution towards higher income.
Now, we then heard from consumer advocates, including Nadi Harrison from Mortgage Stress Victoria, Erin Turner, the Consumer Policy Research Centre, and Dr. Dominique Merrick from the Financial Counselling Australia Group, as well as Julia Davis from the Financial Rights Legal Centre. And Nadia's evidence was very compelling about the risks and pressures on households at the moment.
The position made by consumer groups represented here is focused predominantly on defending Australia's highly effective responsible lending obligations and our prudential lending regime, given the risk of devastating human consequences of any weakening to responsible lending obligations or a premature or knee-jerk reduction to the APRA prudential lending standards. Home loans which expose borrowers to debt beyond their means are financially crippling and emotionally and socially crippling. They're financially crippling given late fees, legal fees, and the transaction costs of a forced sale. An irresponsible home loan can leave homeowner borrowers in insecure housing or homelessness as well as additional debt. And they're emotionally and socially crippling. There's a well-established correlation between home repossessions, extreme mortgage stress and relationship breakdowns, family violence and mental health decline. And that's something that the team here at Mortgage Stress Victoria see on a daily basis. There are thousands of individuals and families behind each non-performing loan statistic, and any suggestion that we should target a higher arrears rate for homeowner borrowers would have a real human cost. We know our regulatory regime is working to prevent financial crisis and housing insecurity because the home repossession data demonstrates it. Responsible lending rules came into force in 2011, and the buffer increased, the serviceability buffer, which we've discussed so much this morning, increased to 3% in 2021. In New South Wales, the New South Wales Supreme Court, between 2006 and 2009, during that global financial crisis period, there were over 5,000 home repossessions each year. In contrast, with comparable hardship in this current cost of living crisis, with significantly higher housing prices. In 2023, there were only 1,413 repossessions, and in 2024, they're projected to be about 1,600. The Queensland and Western Australian court statistics tell a similar story. The Supreme Court of Victoria does not publish its statistics. We also know that the remedies available for irresponsible lending provide a clear disincentives and a cost for harmful lending to banks. Regulators and government should exercise extreme caution in making changes to the buffer, given the human cost of unmanageable debt. The approach that APRA has taken to date demonstrates a cautious restraint and cognizance of the human impact of their decisions. We as a group have every confidence that they will continue to adopt this measured response, and I'm heartened to hear the wholesale support from industry for the regulator today and support for their role and their mandate to guarantee sector resilience. There is not a shortage of housing credit. There is a shortage of affordable housing. Housing credit grew by 5% last year and 4.5% the year before. And as Mr. Taylor from the ABA said this morning, there are more loans being provided to first homeowners than the long run average. So we've got to be clear about the problem that we're actually trying to solve. As a group, we are sympathetic to the policy objective of trying to tip the scales in favour of first home buyers, but getting people into debt that they cannot afford is not the answer. As everyone has said this morning, the main game is housing supply. Any changes to the buffers or weakening of the responsible lending rules would be demand-side measures and could run the risk of further driving price increases. If the committee wants to help more Australians buy a home, it should focus primarily on how to stabilise or gradually reduce the cost of housing overall. I'll close by saying that in the midst of a housing crisis and a mortgage stress crisis, we as a group see an opportunity for a positive agenda from policymakers, which both reverses declining rates of home ownership and gets more first homeowners into the market, but also improves housing security and looks to the experience of homeowners for more consumer-friendly mortgage products. Examples of that ambitious agenda include Australians should have the option of US-style long-term fixed interest rates, tracker mortgages to protect homeowners who can't or won't switch from the loyalty tax that's charged for older variable mortgages, raising the bar, the regulatory standards for non-bank lenders, and consistent standardised hardship guarantees for extreme cases, so including family violence of mortgage stress.
And then we heard from David Locke, June Smith and Natalie Cameron from AFCA, that's the Ombudsman for the Financial System. And they made the point that the mortgage industry was where a lot of pressures are, specifically around financial hardship. They didn't see any need to change the buffers.
The Australian Financial Complaints Authority is the Australian Industry Ombudsman Scheme for the financial services sector and a not-for-profit organisation. Our role is to independently resolve disputes that consumers have with financial firms, and in doing so, to identify systemic issues that may arise and serious contraventions of the law, and to report those to the relevant regulators. The primary touchpoint for AFCA in policy debates about home ownership relates to consumer credit and consumers' experience of the credit products they purchase to buy their homes. And we see this through the complaints work that we do and also through the systemic issues work. We recognise that it is important that consumers can access credit products that meet their needs. And it is also important that the risks and downstream social and economic impacts of unsustainable debt are mitigated. Through our complaints, we see the real-world impacts of poor lending practices and unmanageable debt on consumers. The result can be devastating and overwhelming for people and create lasting hardship impacting families and communities. AFCA is currently seeing an overall increase in banking and finance complaints year on year. We're also seeing a significant and concerning increase in complaints involving financial hardship. And this is particularly where a hardship request has been declined or where there has been a request to suspend enforcement proceedings. And home loans are the most complained about product for consumers in financial hardship. Based upon our data, we observe that many consumers are struggling to meet existing lending commitments. Throughout this year, we have been urging lenders to lift their game when it comes to their responsiveness to hardship requests. In contrast, the number of complaints relating to responsible lending has actually been relatively stable. The key drivers for this include responsible lending obligations, as well as concerted efforts and uplift in standards on the part of the banking industry following the Financial Services Royal Commission. AFCA would be concerned about any weakening of current regulatory settings for consumer credit, which we believe could expose consumers to greater harm and long-lasting hardship.
APRA was then up, and they argued that credit is flowing and is readily available, and there really was little need to change it, remembering that two-thirds of all lending is for housing in Australia, and we have some of the highest and rising debt globally.
The system is financially stable with prudentially strong entities operating within it. And most recent data of August 2024 shows that banks' housing loan commitments are tracking upwards, indicating that credit is flowing and accessible, including to first home buyers. Housing credit growth has increased over the past year and is currently in line with long-term averages. Similarly, first home buyers in line with the long-term average have continued to account for around one in five new housing loans. Secondly, financial system risk in Australia. Household debt is an important consideration for financial system risk in Australia. Australia is one of the highest levels of household debt globally relative to incomes. Over the past 20 years, household debt to income has risen from around 1.5 times income to around 2 times. In percentage terms, APRA-regulated entities have more housing loans on their books than most other comparable countries. Around two-thirds of all loans are for housing in Australia. And finally, APRA is committed to transparency. We have published our macro-prudential framework, which works together with our prudential guidance, through which APRA explicitly endorses banks approving lending outside their default credit policy on an exceptions basis, provided such exceptions are prudently managed. APRA regularly releases reviews of our current macro-prudential settings. We undertake various public speeches, as well as participate in a range of parliamentary inquiries, thereby contributing further to our transparency.
They also did make the point that they look at it from an overall system stability perspective, not by one specific borrower class. And there was a number of discussions there about whether some flexibility for first-time buyers would help. And then we had Kylie Davis, representing the PropTech Association of Australia. That's a whole bunch of people looking at the digitalization of planning and property management. And she called out the analog approach to building. It's been little changed. Less than 5% of properties are prefabricated. And she argued that this is an old approach to underwriting as well. And if they were able to use the open banking digital data, maybe there was an opportunity to reform property underwriting more broadly. Now, I think this was a very interesting submission, but clearly it was beyond the original focus on first home buyers. Linda Coker, Frank Austin, and Liz Roche from Coopity were talking about co-buying and, in fact, quoted digital finance and illicit research on the Bank of Mum and Dad.
We're addressing housing affordability by enabling Australians to co-buy property on title with friends or family. Recent YouGov research earlier this year shows that circa 47% of Australians across demographics would consider co-buying with a friend or non-romantic partner due to affordability concerns. Many don't put the necessary legal protections in place, and what our platform does is provide a simple digital experience to co-buy along with the execution of a co-ownership agreement, which defines the rights and obligations of all co-owners. We believe co-owning with family or friends can help first home buyers onto the property ladder faster and more cost-effectively than some other affordability solutions, as it involves less debt, less fees, and accelerates ownership for more people from in unlocking supply, especially in the inner and middle rings of our cities. It also provides a flexible option for existing homeowners, particularly retirees, to gradually sell down their property investment, optimizing their capital gains while improving their cash position and encouraging wealth transfer across generations. Over the last decade, the Bank of Mum and Dad has grown by circa 2,000%, according to Digital Finance Analytics. Coopity believes parents could co-own on title rather than give money to protect their financial security and retirement. Co-buying enables asset protection and is better than a loan, as banks often view this as a debt of the child hindering their affordability, meaning children can borrow less, bringing forward the transaction. Parents can also use their fraction as security rather than putting the family home at risk. Coopity launched in April of this year, so we're building out a network of trusted partners, mortgage brokers, wealth advisors, accountants, property firms to help them unlock the co-ownership opportunity for their clients. We are in discussions with lenders to try to deliver an integrated co-ownership and lending solution that works for many natural life and family scenarios. For example, parents helping their kids buy, deceased estates with multiple children inheriting, divorce, granny flats, which can be fractionalized because they're not on separate title, and later in life co-buying. However, lending policies remain restrictive, and we believe they fail to recognise that the credit risk is lower when people co-buy as a cohort, as stamp duty, mortgage repayments and ongoing costs are shared, albeit liquidity risk is higher currently as there's not an established secondary market for percentage shares of residential property.
They argued that the current lending policies are somewhat restrictive. For example, you need to have 30% of the property owned to be on the mortgage. And as a result of that, serviceability is potentially assessed against the kids, when in fact parents might also be interested in supporting the borrower. And then we had evidence from Alexander Horden, the Insurance Council of Australia, and also Pauline Blight-Johnson from Helia. By the way, Helia is the new name for Genworth Mortgage Insurance and is the biggest LMI provider in Australia. So there was a discussion there about how LMI helps or doesn't help. And that was an interesting discussion insofar that earlier on, the Green Senator was pushing very strongly for some of the major banks to effectively take over the lender's mortgage insurance, bearing in mind, of course, that LMI protects the lender, not the borrower, and can be very costly. Helia argued that, in fact, it would make sense to keep LMI because, of course, a number of smaller lenders had less access and less capacity to support borrowers without it. Then we had three private submissions from Professor John Quiglin, Saul Eslake, and Ben Spice-Butcher, speaking in private capacities.
Decades of evidence that I believe shows overwhelmingly that in a supply-constrained housing market, which we have now and have had for most of the past six decades, anything that allows Australians to spend more on housing than they would otherwise be able to do results in more expensive housing rather than in a higher proportion of the population owning that housing, and that while inevitably individuals are able to benefit from various government programs and other developments that allow them individually to spend more on housing than they otherwise would, indirectly, their benefits are at the expense of other Australians who, for whatever reason, aren't able to take advantage of those programs or those developments. And I would say that although I recognise some arguments for example, loosening the buffers that APRA requires to test the capacity of prospective borrowers to service loans at higher interest rates, they would in general come into that category of things that allow Australians to spend more buying housing than they'd be able to otherwise. And the likely result of it would be more expensive housing rather than higher home ownership rates.
Oh, and he also argued that access for super for housing is also a bad idea for the same reason.
You make an argument that that stimulus on the demand side just kicks up the price and locks out people from being able to purchase and doesn't address the true problem. But not all supply and not all demand is the same, is it? And I just want to give you the stats for the last 10 years on population change, 15%, increase in the number of dwellings, 19%, but increase in price for housing of 75%. So what we have, you're nodding. What's going on there? We have had a lot of supply come in the last 10 years. We've seen it push up the price because of the composition of the purchaser, I think. So,
well, your comment. There's a couple of things at work there. One, that growth in the population itself is an incomplete measure of the growth in the underlying demand for housing, because various social changes have had the effect of reducing the number of people per dwelling, such as smaller families, the ageing of the population, and family breakdown, all result in, on average, fewer people per dwelling, and thus a greater underlying requirement for housing for any given increase in the population. Second, there appears to have been, as far as you can tell from census data, an increase in the ownership of second homes, holiday homes and things like that, that are vacant for much of the year and only used by their owner rather than being let out. Relatedly, there's been an increase in the proportion of the housing stock that is not occupied by its owners but is used for short-stay tourist accommodation, including presumably for overseas tourists as well as interstate Australian tourists. That would have impacted the relationship between population growth and housing demand. The final thing, of course, is that when economists talk about housing demand, they're not only talking about the number of people demanding houses to live in or even to own for an investment purpose, but also how much they're able to and willing to pay for it. So, in other words, what's driven prices is not simply the difference between the number of households requiring accommodation and the stock of housing, but also the financial resources that those who buy housing are able to bring to the task, to the business of acquiring housing. And in addition to government schemes that put cash in people's hands, such as first-time owner grants and stamp duty concessions or tax concessions for property investors or mortgage guarantee schemes or shared equity schemes, but in addition, things that are not the result of government policy, but lower interest rates and easier credit conditions have made it possible for people who would have been able to buy a home anyway to buy a more expensive one or to pay more for a house than they otherwise would. And in a supply-constrained market where people have the capacity to spend more on housing as a result of something, be it a government policy or a development in financial markets, then the result is more expensive housing. And that's what the history of the last six decades, and in particular, the history of the last three decades since interest rates came down from their late 80s, early 90s peak, tells us.
In your submission to previous inquiries, you've made a number, you've said investor demand has been a major cause driving up house prices. How has the interaction of negative gearing and capital gains tax discount contributed to the last decade or thereabouts of house price growth, declines in the home ownership rate and wealth inequality?
Well, I would say that you have to go to 1999, when the capital gains tax regime was changed from what it had been since 1985, imposing capital gains tax at a taxpayer's full marginal rate, less an allowance for the impact of CPI inflation on the value of the asset, to a regime which taxed the nominal gain at half the taxpayer's otherwise applicable marginal rate. What that did was to convert negative gearing from a strategy that had always been about deferring tax to one which was about both deferring and reducing the amount of tax, by in effect converting wage and salary income into capital gains. Wage and salary income, of course, is taxable in the financial year in which you earn it. Capital gains are taxable in the year in which you choose to realise the gain by selling the asset, and since 1999, taxed at half the otherwise applicable marginal rate. So although the number or the proportion of taxpayers who were negatively geared property investors had been rising during the 1990s, in part, I suspect, because the terms on which banks would lend for investment properties eased in the early 90s. The premium on interest rates for investor loans disappeared in the 1990s. But there was a dramatic increase in the proportion of the population who had property investments, and in the proportion of those who had property investments who were negatively geared, reaching a peak, I think, of about 70% just before the onset of the global financial crisis. Now, over the following 13 years, as interest rates came down, and particularly during the COVID period, the proportion of property investors who were negatively geared fell substantially, simply because it became very difficult to be negatively geared when interest rates were as low as they were. Mm. I suspect that when we get figures for 2023-24, which won't be until 2026, the proportion of property investors who are negatively geared will have gone back to somewhere close to where it was at its peak in 2007-08. I also argued to the second part of your question that although defenders of negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount maintain that it is essential to ensuring an adequate supply of rental housing, over 70% of the amount of money that's lent to property investors for the purchase of housing is for the purchase of established housing. Mm. Which means that those investors who purchase established housing are not adding to the supply of housing. They may be adding to the supply of rental housing, but in outbidding a prospective owner-occupier for the established houses which they purchase, they are adding to the demand for rental housing by exactly the same amount. Mm. So that if negative gearing and or the capital gains tax discount were to be curtailed in some way, or even dispensed with entirely for established housing, then it may well be true that that reduces the supply of established housing that's available for rent, but it would reduce the demand for it by exactly the same amount, and there would therefore be no impact on rent at all. Mm-hmm. And if the end result of any reforms in this area were to be that new housing was the only investment vehicle for which negative gearing and or a capital gains discount was available, the result may well be an increase in investment in new residential housing for rent, which would be a good thing, in my view.
Thank you. Thanks for all of that. If I can come to you, Professor Spears-Butcher, what suggestions are top of your list for improving housing affordability and home ownership rates without pushing up house prices?
Thank you, Senator. And I broadly agree, just to say, with the analysis that Mr. Eslake gave. But I think it's also in the context where the liberalisation of financial markets and a broader shift in profit models globally has increasingly emphasised both capital gains and leverage as models for being able to convert annual income into capital gains income effectively. So that's not just happening here, but here that's happening a lot, and it's particularly happening through housing because of the way credit markets work, which is that, you know, most people can't borrow 80% of the money to invest in BHP shares, but they can borrow 80% of the money to invest in another home or another investment property. And so that skews, this interaction effect is very important. So I think changes that disincentivize models which are based on capital gains as the primary or as a primary mechanism for realizing income are going to have positive impacts on affordability. And so that goes to the capital gains tax concession, it goes to negative gearing. I think it even goes to the capital gains tax exemption for the family home as well in an era where being able to own a property is less likely to be as universal as it was in the past. And I think there's an argument about that. But I think it also goes to a couple of the things which are, you might say, creating a floor under the market. One is just how important the mortgage market is to the wealth effect in Australia and to macroeconomic management, as well as to credit ratings generally, and also to employment in the construction industry, which I think it's reasonable to infer that some of the emergency action during the GFC and COVID were a response to the negative implications of a rapid and sudden fall in house prices. And to the extent that that's the case, then I think the government has implicitly assumed some of the downside risk, which is reinforcing this model. But you also notice that at those moments when prices fall and investors are clearly worried about the prospects of capital gains into the future, you see a sharp uptake of first home buyers into the market who aren't concerned primarily about capital gains. They're concerned about tenure. And this lopsidedness is caused by the unevenness of tenure distribution. And so it's because private rental is so bad in terms of its tenure, and that for many people who have the means to be able to invest differently, it means, you know, moving schools with their kids, having to move further away from family, even having to change jobs regularly because of the insecurity of tenure in the rental market, that also artificially creates a floor. So I think we want to, if the policy goal is to create secure tenure, then I think directly creating secure tenure by ensuring that all private rentals are more secure, and by expanding the stock of public housing and social housing, which guarantees tenure security, is a much more direct way of being able to address these issues. And I think doesn't have the entry of public investment doesn't have the same problems that the subsidy of private investment has because of its ability to guarantee tenure, its ability to target new construction, for example, as well. And partly the relatively low cost because the government's already assumed some of the downside risk. And so when it comes in, it's actually effectively coming in to get more upside and less downside. So I think those tenure security measures are really important. The tax changes that disincentivise capital gains-oriented models and investment are really important in order to be able to address the problems. Thank you.
Can I bring you in, Professor Quinn, on these issues? What is your response to that? What's your view about what's most important to get right now on housing to improve, to deal with inequality and improve housing affordability?
Yeah, in my view, the security of tenure issue is really the biggest single one combined, I guess, with increasing supply. But and so that's, I've mentioned that I don't think creative schemes like shared equity are really going to do any good. I think the Housing Australia Future Fund had a whole bunch of features which cosmetically made things look good, but really were not very useful. So in my view, what we need to do is develop a better rental sector than we have, which means returning to public housing, which has largely been abandoned, but also addressing the non-welfare part of the market through build to rent. And I think those two things together are essentially what, you know, the so-called NIMBY movement is largely about, of providing incentives to providing a structure which creates something more stable than the kind of reliance on individual contracts between tenants and landlords with one or two or three properties. I think that's a recipe for poor tenure and so forth, and that's been incentivised, of course, by the structure of capital gains discounts and negative gearing that favour that mode of investment, which of course isn't relevant at all either to social housing or to a corporate type build to rent model.
So standing back, what do we make of all this? Well, so far as reducing the 3% buffer for first home buyers, I don't think that passes muster, and certainly some of the banks are arguing against it, not least because of the higher risk profiles of first-time buyers. Now, and I think it's worth saying up front that a lot of the focus in the submissions was to tackle supply of property rather than looking narrowly at the lending changes that were being mooted. And more broadly, as you stand back, it's clear that the supply issues are important, but I also think that we should avoid changes that would actually get people into even more debt. The debt pressure is already there, if anybody wants to see it. And some of the changes being spoken about with regard to tax and potentially also introducing back more public housing is probably part of the solution. So the bottom line is this: there is no simple silver bullet to solving the housing problem. And I have to say that I think the banks who were advocating for a reduction in the lending parameters for first-time buyers are really missing the point, given the fact that credit is still expanding significantly at a time of high interest rates, and capacity doesn't seem to be constraining that even now, which is what, of course, some of the other banks argued. So, did this help? Well, possibly so. Maybe it showed to the senators that there are no simple answers here. And that's because this is a big, complex, multifaceted can of worms, and no one action can actually solve the problem. On the other hand, a very coherent set of multifaceted strategies could take home ownership rates higher and deal with some of the pain. But frankly, the bottom line is lending more helps nobody. Saul S. Lake is spot on. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.